We get two kinds of comments when I say we, the Access Board, gets two kinds of comments from industry. One is make it very clear, make it very finite, be very prescriptive. And the other is give us flexibility.
Well, hello and welcome to the ADA Shop Talk Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Klein. And if you are an ADA coordinator, government official, architect, or accessibility specialist trying to better understand the ADA, then you are in the right place. The ADA Shop Talk Podcast is brought to you by Blue Dag. Check out Blue Dag's Transition Plan Builder and Inspection Suite over at bluedag.com for all the great info. And I'm so glad you're here today. Had a nice weekend and starting off the week here. But more than anything else, I've got a special, special guest, someone who I've heard about for so many years as a career in this ADA space. And actually, I think when I called the U.S. Access Board line, I would probably talk to her for an interpretation over the years and just never realized it. But always heard of her, and I'm finally got to meet her in real life via Zoom. But and she's my guest today, and that is Marcia Maz. She is the Director of Accessibility Codes and Standards at the United Spinal Association, and the former Director of Office and Technical Information for the U.S. Access Board. So, Marcia Maz, so glad you're here. How are you doing today?
Great, Paul. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I'm so excited to talk to you. I use your I've known you've been at the Access Board forever. I know, man. It's already been quite a few years. You've been with United Spinal now, hasn't it?
About 6, yeah.
Wow, 6 years already. Just in my mind, I've always remembered you being at the Access Board because you were there. I think we were talking offline here, Minnie. You've been there since like 1980. You were there from like 1989. Is that when you started there?
1989 to 2018.
Man, so you were there before the enactment of the ADA, during it, and all the implementation. And I remember calling the info line over the years early on, and then taking some of your seminars at the ADA national thing. And what else was there? I remember the training videos. I used those over the years, and you were one of the stars on one of those, weren't you?
Much to my embarrassment, yes.
No, and I think you did it was the visually impaired one, right? That you were in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right. I never knew that about you. So that was,
it's a well-kept secret, I guess. I don't hide it, but people don't seem to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it's like anything, as you know, Marcia, everybody just thinks we're either blind or you're not. And there's a lot of in-between disabilities that we fail to forget. Some of us forget about so many times, or like a lot of people, they just think it's grab bars and wheelchairs, you know?
That's right. Well, as a matter of fact, Pat Wright used to tell me that I was born with the wrong disability because most of my work is about grab bars and wheelchairs.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But man, what a great experience being there through the historical and monumental time. And then I imagine over the years, and I really love for you to speak on, over the years when you were at the Access Board, how it was working, what did you do? And, I know you worked with a lot of entities around, but tell us a little bit about that, that time when you were at the Access Board.
Well, from the beginning, I think my primary goal was to try and get more accessibility into state and local building codes and standards. Mm. And even though, the ADA gave the Access Board and the Department of Justice and Department of Transportation a pretty big hammer, I was pretty darn aware that the resources that the government would have to enforce the ADA were going to be thin. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I felt we could really ensure decent accessibility was to have the same provisions enforced on the local level as local building code. Because the code officials really are our allies, and they are our first line of defense as far as I'm concerned. And yes, some of them are not wonderful, and others are wonderful. But at least you have that whole network of enforcers who are trying to do the right thing and looking at accessibility critically when it's still in the design stage, as it becomes, more fully developed and before the occupancy permit is granted. And having that close scrutiny really makes a huge difference. And so that's where I kind of put my most of my energies, along with my regular part of my job, which was to develop accessibility codes and standards. So I was the lead staff on the update of the ADA standards. I was a junior staff person in the original ADA standards. Ruth Lusher headed up that effort with Jim Raggio, and I worked for Ruth. Later on, when I was more seasoned, I led the update of the ADA and Architectural Barriers Act accessibility guidelines, and including the advisory committee that we convened to work on that. And then I saw the completion of the Section 508 standards, medical diagnostic equipment standards, and the furtherance of the public rights of way accessibility guidelines, and also the passenger vessel accessibility guidelines that haven't really finished up yet, but
pretty much all you've been involved with all of that, man. There's like so many questions I want to ask. It's like it's so fascinating. And and I explain this to a lot of times in our, well, first off, let me say that I think the 2010 rewrite was just such an improvement. 91 was great, but it was the first thing out of the gate, and the 2010 is so much easier to use. And in California and a lot of states, Texas, Florida, all adopted that as their state standard, and there's a lot of congruity there, which is great.
Yeah, the 91 really, Paul, was a sort of an update to the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standards. It was for ADA. And that was our charge from Congress. And moreover, we only had 9 months to do it,
Oh, wow.
including public comment period. And so
Wow.
they had given us a statutory deadline and said we had to do it within 9 months. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to consider new and different things like playground or any of that kind of stuff. It was,
Yes.
pretty much a hurried job. In fact, the Department of Justice adopted it on the day we published it.
Oh, wow.
Which isn't too surprising since they're on the access board. They have a vote on the access
Yeah.
board. But it was a hurried job, and so there wasn't a lot of time to for any of us to become familiar with the way codes and standards are written typically. And I like to tell people, and I try to translate between architects and engineers and codes and standards people and disability rights organizations, because disability rights organizations tend to want the language to be a little bit loosey-goosey so that it can, mean what we want it
Yeah.
to mean. And codes and standards people want precision.
Yeah.
They want to know exactly what they have to do and that they aren't going to end up in jail because they did
Yeah.
something wrong and they didn't know they did it wrong.
Right. Yeah, that's so true. And yeah, that's one of the things that I explain to people is, if you look at our codes and standards in the United States as a whole, and fire life safety particularly, the first building code was built in 1922 or 23 or something like that. So there was almost 60 years of code development, tragedies, improvements, code hearings, you know, gnashing of the teeth, debate, you know, hashing out. So the exiting codes and the egress is very vetted and a lot better. Still not perfect by any means, but a lot better. So if you think about the ADA, it's still in its infancy. I mean, it's only been, what, 30, 35 years, you know, that, and like you said, you were kind of inventing the wheel. You're taking the UFAS, and then you only have 9 months, you know, so you, it was impossible to hit all of, get it perfect right out of the gate. It did darn pretty good, but compared to, you know, like the building codes and the exiting codes and fire codes that have 60 years of history, I mean, we barely have.
Well, they have way more than 60 years. The first building code was written by Hammurabi, and I don't know, the
BC something, yeah. That's right. If you build it wrong, you shall die, or something like that.
Something like that. Don't burn this building.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that's what people, you know, that when they get frustrated, and especially a lot of the black and white code people that want everything to be spelled out, and they, you know, they think, oh, just that's all that ADA stuff. None of it makes sense. But, you know, we're still relatively in the infancy, and I think we've made huge improvements
We are. It's funny because we get two kinds of comments. When I say we, the Access Board gets two kinds of comments from industry. One is make it very clear, make it very finite, be very prescriptive. And the other is give us flexibility.
Yeah.
And those two demands are kind of hard to live with.
Yeah.
None of the code officials, none of the architects or engineers really like that equivalent facilitation provision that's in the ADA accessibility guidelines and in the DOJ ADA standards, because they feel, and it's funny because when we first wrote it, I thought, geez, we're giving them a blank check. But they feel that there's too much risk attached to substituting a different way of doing things unless there's some proven track record on that substitution.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. It's that whole prescriptive versus performance debate and with codes and, you know, finding that sweet spot. I know one thing that I really liked that you guys did that seems to be more prevalent and kind of trending is we've got a lot more ranges now than absolutes in dimensions. And maybe you could talk a little bit on that in the history of, you know, cause we all know if it's, you know, if it's 34 to 38 and it's 38 and an eighth, 38 and a 16th, it's not within the range. That becomes a barrier, even though as trivial as it seems, that's why you have the range. Whereas like for many years, we had the 18 absolute on the toilet. Right. Now we've got the 16 to 18, which I love because construction is imperfect.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because the Access Board hired David K. Ballast, who is probably the preeminent tolerance guy in the world. And after a lot of effort on his part, trying to get, for example, the concrete industry to say what should be a tolerance for concrete in terms of smoothness and keeping, you know, keeping the concrete not just smooth, but at the slope you want it to be at.
Mm-hmm.
He really couldn't get them to nail that down. And one of the conclusions of that whole study that he did is architects are forgetting that some of these numbers are ranges, and they have to design within the range so that mistakes in the field don't cause the elements to be out of
place. Exactly, yeah.
So we had architects, for example, designing ramps at 1 and 12. Well, if you design it at 1 and 12, chances are good it's going to be steeper than 1 and 12 here and there.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when we redid the section on, or when we redid the ranges and we put some things in a range that weren't in a range, we also had a companion change to the tolerance section. And that tolerance section said, if there is a stated range of, say, for example, 16 to 18 inches, then there is no tolerance.
Right.
Because the designer can work within the range and the builder can work within the range. And so there is no construction tolerance. That was kind of a first.
Yeah.
For accessibility anyway. And the only reason that we allow the tolerance to continue for things like numbers where there's no minimum and only a max.
Like the inch and a half between.
Or no max and only a minimum.
Yeah.
Was that we felt that people were just unaccustomed to understanding that was also a range. Either with zero or infinity.
Yeah.
And so we allowed that tolerance on those, but there aren't very many of them left in the state.
No, there's not very many. And just to clarify, so we're all on the same page if you're listening, mm-hmm. If they're like the grab bar height is, what is that, 34 to 36 to the center line of the, is it 34? I think it's 34 to 36. 33. I'm on the spot with Marsha Maz. I'm going to mess up. 34 to 36.
I think it's 33 to 36, but don't quote me.
Okay. Well, I'm going with you because my memory's bad and I'm on the spot with Marsha Maz. So, no, it's so we'll just go with that. Let's just say you have a range of 33 to 36. And so you can't go, 32 7/8, 32 3/4. You can't go 36 1/8, or even though it's an eighth. And I've heard the contractors and everything that range is your construction tolerance. And then the one that always comes up.
But the other thing we had to fix was to tell them where to measure that.
Oh, right. Yes.
Because in some cases we didn't specify center line or top of rail.
Yeah.
And so we made it clear that it's from the gripping, so the top of the gripping surface, which is the top of the rail.
Yeah. Yeah. It used to be center line or whatever. Yeah. Was always difficult. And then, so where you have a, like the one that always comes up is cross slope. It says, so the accessible route shall not exceed a 2% or 1 in 20, I can't remember what it is. Let's just go with 2%, but I know it's like 2 point whatever, but, that, and so 0 to 2% is your construction tolerance, but technically there is a little bit of tolerance, especially when it comes to the material in this case, which would be concrete, correct?
Well, here's the thing. You can never specify a tolerance without also looking at materials and methods.
Right.
Okay. Because any tolerance for example, asphalt is going to be different from concrete.
Yeah.
It's not the same material, doesn't behave the same way in the field. So if you look for tolerances, you're going to find tolerances, published tolerances for concrete and asphalt and, whatever the materials you're using, but they're always specific to those materials.
Right.
So anybody who says, well, I give it a tolerance of X, well, they're not really giving it a tolerance. Tolerances A are specified by the industry, the affected industry.
Right.
And B are specific to materials and C specific to methods.
Right.
Whatever method you're using to install that material. So where we have the 2% cross slope, 2% max cross slope, since it says 2% max and it doesn't say 0 to 2, it says 2% max, you do get a tolerance there. But I would be looking for a tolerance as specified by the industry for the materials that were used.
Like ACI.
Exactly. Yeah. I wouldn't just make it up.
No.
Now there are some made up tolerances that are floating around in the country and people use them. Those are really not tolerances. Those are sort of alternative standards.
Alternative
or
standards.
Maybe yeah, and they make some sense. You hear about the 3-6-9 rule, 3% max cross slope, 6% for a walking surface, that kind of thing.
Yeah, 9 for a 9% ramp.
9% instead of 8.33 for 1-12 slope. You hear those things, and they make sense because in the end, measurement techniques are not that precise.
Right.
Nobody can say that their instrument is always going to precisely measure everything, because instruments are affected by the environment as well.
Right.
Not just human error.
Yeah.
Like you didn't calibrate your level right. But they're also affected by cold. They're affected by, you know, grit and sand and things on the surface. So some of that makes sense, but those are sort of rules of thumb as opposed to a true tolerance.
Right. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And a lot of times that's what we see in all areas of code, is that common practice becomes code. But then when you try to go find the code path or back it up, so whatever your role is, I mean, you could be just doing a best practices review or a code review or a litigation review, wherever you are, you've got, at some point you're going to have to be able to back it up. And I think to your point, Marcia, is that it's got, for to invoke construction tolerances, you have to be able to look at the material and the methods and the standard available and apply that on a case by case basis. So making blanket rules is going to get us in trouble. So we don't want to just say, oh, I'll allow a 2.5, blah, blah, blah. Well, great. That's not reality. So that's,
but there's always a certain amount of leeway a surveyor has as to when they call something out.
Right. Right.
I mean, if you find one little spot that is 3% cross-sloped, but generally that root is perfect, and you have, you know, basically the width of a wheelchair wheels, 30 inches width, half all the way up that thing, then that little dip isn't going to matter too much if you can find that path. At least that's my opinion.
Oh, I agree with you. I love that you're saying that, because I've seen, let's just say, out in California, we'd call them high frequency litigants with a 6-inch torpedo level on an 80-foot by 20-foot wide path, sidewalk. And they find one little divot, you know, over in a corner that's not going to even be a barrier to anybody in a power chair, let alone probably even in a, I mean, it was just, you know, and it's like 2.3 in one little spot. And they're using a torpedo level out of all things, you know, instead of a, at least be like the contractor and use an 8-foot level, but on that much concrete. But I always say, yeah, the high frequency litigants use a torpedo level. The contractors use an eight foot or a 4-foot level, and us access surveyors use 2-foot levels. So, I don't know.
That's because that's what fits in your suitcase.
That's true. That's true. Although when I went through JFK one time, they confiscated, they've got a brand new Stabilo over there somewhere.
Ouch.
I know. So I learned to check a bag after that, but I've been ever since TSA pre, I'm able to get through pretty good. And it's a digital instrument.
They don't call it a level. They say you have to call it a slopometer.
Or I call it a digital instrument, not a tool. Because I think a tool is subject to like 6 or 8 inches. So it's a digital instrument is the way I've been able to talk my way through it a few times. But no, that's great. Let's change subject a little. We got real technical there, so I appreciate that. That's good stuff there. People are going to love that, because construction tolerances are always a, and I think you summed it up well there. But one thing I'd like to pick your brain on, if you have some feedback or whatever, we talked about vagueness in the code versus prescriptive versus performance. Touch on readily achievable. I know when they first were looking at that, you know, there was some talk about, okay, you need to spend 20% of your construction budget, or, you know, how come we ended up with such a vague, I know why, but I wonder if you have any background or experience on how we ended up where we are, because it would be so convenient to say, okay, you're Walmart, you need to spend $2 million a year on ADA upgrades. Your mom and pop, you're barely making $2,000 a month. Well, you need to spend $200. You know, if there was some kind of mathematical way to readily achieve everybody, but there isn't.
As far as I know, there's no mathematical way to do that. But the DOJ in the regulations make it very clear that they're going to be looking at all your resources. It's not just cash on hand.
Mm-hmm.
It's also all of your corporate relations, you know.
Yeah.
your parent company, if you have a parent company. So And I've heard,
yeah,
you
a franchise.
Together,
yeah, what they
franchise, that's the word I was looking for. I've heard people say, that franchises, are just mom and pop stores. Well, not quite. And it depends.
Yeah.
And the lawyers are always going to say it depends.
Yeah.
And so if someone has the desire to enforce that readily achievable barrier removal, they or their attorneys or accountants are going to be looking at what monies that entity could draw upon. And one of the things I tell our clients at Accessibility Services for United Spinal is, you're going to be doing this big alteration to your conference room and putting in all kinds of bangs and whistles and nice wood and all
yeah.
of this stuff. It's going to be hard for you to claim with a straight face that it's not readily achievable to install a parking space.
Yeah. Exactly. Yep.
I mean, I would be looking at how have you been spending your money since the ADA?
Right. Yeah. Have you couldn't at least afford the $6 sticker or the sign, I mean, come on. I mean, yeah, some of it's pretty obvious. And, it's the old, what Mark, my business partner, Mark Wood, and I would call, does it pass the sniff test?
Yes.
And if it's just blatantly like obvious that you haven't done, I can't say it on the air, Jack of trades, then you probably ought to be doing a little more here. I mean, come on, it's been 35 years.
Yeah. And readily achievable is what people well-intending and, people who appreciate the person with a disability as a customer have always done.
Right.
They've done what they can do when
yeah.
they can do it.
Yeah.
And so this readily achievable barrier removal obligation is sort of encoding what is good behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
And good customer treatment. And it has always been that way. I mean, there's plenty of businesses you can point to that made themselves more accessible before the ADA and continue to make themselves more accessible.
Yeah, it's just good business. There's that 2018 study that was like in, it's like some $3 trillion, half the teenage market. I know that of discretionary income that people with disabilities. So we want them in our businesses and it makes sense to, if there's a coffee shop with a nice parking stall and a path to travel in versus one with steps and no parking stall, well, they're going to take their money to the one that they can get into a lot easier. It's just good business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But readily achievable barrier removal is a much broader obligation than many people understand.
Yeah.
It goes far beyond the ADA standards, for example. Readily achievable barrier removal is what DOJ points to when you ask, for example, do I have to make the non-fixed seats in this restaurant accessible?
Mm-hmm.
And DOJ will point to readily achievable barrier removal and say, you can't have all high-top tables, even if they're furniture, because you are discriminating against people with disabilities.
Right.
And not because you don't comply with the ADA standards, because DOJ is very clear that the ADA standards, when it comes to furniture, should be used as a guide, not as a standard. But what else have you got?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, practically speaking, everybody who designs furniture should be looking at the ADA standards and making sure that some of that furniture accommodates people with disabilities.
Yeah, yeah. If you have
these restaurants with high top tables are just absolutely aberrant. I mean, they don't make any sense at all for lots of customers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like to sit down on a lower table, just personal preference. I don't like those tall ones, and unless I'm standing, but yeah, and I think those outdoor patios and, I mean, accessible route being 36 inches and, yeah, and you hear the pushback, I'm sure you've heard before, well, the standards don't apply to non-fixed built-in elements. But no, the ADA,
yeah.
the ADA still
ADA
applies.
Does, though.
And what do you follow?
ADA
follow
removal obligation.
Yeah, and follow the best standard available. And it's kind of like PROAG, you know, cities and counties for on-street parking and so forth. We don't have to do that. It's not in the, you know, in the
ADA
standards, so we don't have to do anything. It's like, no, you have to follow the best available standard. If you don't develop your own, you probably ought to follow the guidelines.
Well, not to mention the fact that the Department of Transportation funds nearly every public right-of-way in America. And they already, you know, are telling people and have been telling people for years to use the draft POAG and then the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking as a guide when providing accessibility, because there's, they say it's required under Section 504.
Yeah.
You know, and here are all these cities signing these statements that after they receive all this federal funding and saying, oh yes, we comply with every applicable law, every applicable standard. Well, if they're providing on-street parking and they're not providing some measurable accessibility, they're out of compliance with that statement that they signed, which could lead to a False Claims Act lawsuit on the part of the government. The government could sue them for making false claims.
Yeah, that's so.
And they have done that.
Yeah. And I heard a number, something like there's roughly 24,000 Title II entities nationwide, and I heard a number something real low, like maybe 4,000 have had really done a comprehensive transition and self-evaluation plan. Have you ever heard any stats like that or anything similar?
I can't quote any stats on it, but it sounds about right. Here's the problem: the people that PRJ doesn't scare that many people, I don't think, because look at their track record. They almost always resolve a complaint with a settlement.
Mm-hmm.
The DOJ doesn't go after most entities, you know, and try and wring blood from a turnip. They try and settle for a reasonable amount of accessibility. But there are those people who do make a living suing folks, but they only do that primarily under Title III. You don't see a lot of those folks doing that under Title II of the ADA, because it's not as lucrative and because the defendant has a lot more resources.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that and I'd like you to talk a little bit about that is when you have a Title II entity, and I know there's one up in NorCal I can think of. I won't say the name, but I know this must have been in late 90s, early 2000s. They ignored the DOJ, taking the grants, certifying everything. You know, I don't know all the particulars, but in summary, what happened is the DOJ finally did come in due to complaints or non-compliance or whatever with self-evaluation and transition plan. And then they basically, under a consent decree, said, you will funnel all capital improvement projects to ADA improvements for the next 3 years. We want a monthly report on how you're making progress, and we're going to visit you every 6 months. I mean, they literally no more city fountains and ballparks. I mean, they literally had to funnel all of their financial resources for like 3 years to catch up what they should have been or claiming had been doing for a long time. Have you heard some similar stories like that with other entities in the?
I've heard some, but frankly, I don't find that most lawsuits result in very good follow up, even the settlement agreements.
With the DOJ? You mean even with the DOJ?
No, the private ones more often than the DOJ ones, although even DOJ doesn't have infinite resources. You know, so DOJ is they're gonna settle for the best they can get, and I don't know what their process is for reviewing for continued compliance after they've settled. But I do know with the private lawsuits, oftentimes the people take their money and run and never look back. And that's a shame because they've gone to all the trouble of suing somebody for accessibility ostensibly, And then they don't make sure that the accessibility actually happens
No.
after they've gotten, the money. And that's too bad.
Yeah, it is. Well, they each sign a statement that makes the other party happy. The plaintiff signs a statement saying, "I won't ever sue you again." The defendant, the business owner, signs a statement that "I'll fix everything." Well, they exchange money and then they go on their separate ways. And there's, like you said, there's no follow up. And unfortunate for people with need the barriers removed, and for the business owners, is that money could have went towards, $15,000 settlement, average settlement in California. I don't know what it is everywhere else, but somewhere around there, roughly. That's a lot of money that could go to parking stalls and ramps, and a lot of barriers can be removed for $15,000, even though things are expensive. But still,
get out there, fix those barriers, and potentially avoid those losses.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to shift gears a little bit, and we're almost up on the time, but man, this is such great. I could talk to you for another hour, but I know you're busy and lots of things. But tell us what's kind of on the horizon that you're hearing in your circles, that the Access Board. I mean, are we going to see a bigger unisex restroom? Are we going to see, what are just some insights that you're sniffing out or hearing about that we might be seeing coming in the future here, down the pipeline from your perspective?
Well, I will tell you that almost everybody, not everybody, but nearly everybody that I either hired or worked with at the Access Board has moved on at this point. They've had a lot of turnover since I left. And so it's harder to keep my ear to the ground, but I see that, a lot of energy is going into information and communications technology. I do read their regulatory plan. So I don't see anything on it about an update to the ADA standards generally. To incorporate the new criteria in the ICC 817, which ironically the Access Board funded.
Oh.
the Access Board funded the research that resulted in changes to the ANSI standard. Those changes are going to be brought about in through state medical building codes. And they're very important. They're very important. It was shocking to me to find out how few, particularly people in motorized wheelchairs and scooters, what a small percentage of that population was adequately served by the clear floor space and the turning space that we provide in the ADA standards. And so the new criteria, although probably not enough for Ed Steinfeld, because he would have liked to see a lot more change based on his research out of Buffalo, University of Buffalo, at the Idea Center. But even though his data is rock solid.
Yeah.
And we have, and it's been peer reviewed. It is significant, in terms of statistically significant. All of that is there. Even then, we have a lot of people who want to discount that research and want to say, "Oh, well, we don't need these big spaces." And I'm totally convinced we do need them.
Yeah.
That people are using bigger devices to get more range, to get more, independence. They're doing their grocery shopping in that big shopping bag or a knapsack on the back of your wheelchair. It takes up space too.
Yeah.
So there's these new criteria do make sense, and I'm hoping that as agencies start to update their 504 standards, they take a look at the ICC 817 as a rival to the ADA standards.
Yeah.
Because ICC 817, in my opinion, provides greater accessibility for the most part.
Okay.
And is because of, in part because of these new space requirements, but also because it's continued to evolve. If you think about the 2010 ADA standards, there's like six or eight things that DOJ tacked on to ADAG when they adopted ADAG. ADAG, the last ADAG, was written in 2004. Or 2006, sorry, 2006. So it's almost 20 years old.
Yeah.
And the government just doesn't have the resources to continue to evolve the standards the way they need to. And NICC does have those resources and has a lot of talent committed to developing those changes. So I think it's time for the government to adopt all the updates from A117, adopt the A117, and then take it from there and start developing new areas of investigation.
Right.
New areas that because we're not even half done. I mean, there's so many things that aren't addressed.
Yeah, like Airbnbs and Lyfts, and Airbnb's a big one.
All kinds of facilities that you know aren't addressed with technical standards.
Yeah.
And could be addressed with appropriate technical standards, including things like the entertainment experiences that exist now that didn't exist in the past.
Right.
And one of the good things that IBC, International Building Code, and the A117 have done is we've brought forward the appendix to the 2017 ICC A117 for adult changing tables.
Oh, yeah.
And that is already scoped in the building code. So that those adult changing tables will start showing up in facilities, I hope, within the next few years. And that is a huge deal.
Yeah,
I
it is.
Remember when I was approached at the Access Board by somebody whose child needed a larger changing table, and you know, and she couldn't change them on the floor of the bathroom at the local, you know, department store. She needed a clean and safe way to change them. And we said we would look into it. Well, we've been looking into it. You know, the federal government's been looking into it for a long time, and now the private sector has taken the lead, and I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, yeah. I know California implemented that last code cycle, I think in the 2019, and it seems to be pretty smooth and good amendment, and well received out there. So I'm sure it'll be something we need, and I'll get in there. And just to clarify, which is the most, I know I've been using the 2009 and 2017 ANSI, but what ANSI are we up to now? What's the most current?
Well, we're developing the 2024 or 2025 A117 now.
Okay.
And I'm on the committee, and but because we wanted that adult changing table criteria to get out quickly, we released it as an appendix to the 2017 A117, rather than sitting on it until the next edition of A117
came out. Okay, perfect.
So it's you know, there are also, there are a lot of horizon issues. We have, I think it's 2009, maybe it was 2017, we incorporated criteria for acoustics in classrooms, and that makes it huge difference to children who are hard of hearing, or even children without disabilities who speak English as a second language and need a good acoustical environment to, you know, acquire that language.
Yeah.
And so that's also in the IBC. It's not in the ADA.
Yeah.
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 So there just are, you know, that and the space requirements. If it were only those two things, there are three things, the space requirements, the adult changing tables, and the classroom acoustics, That's reason enough.
Yeah, that's a huge improvement right there. And it's not like most code cycles. I know out in, keep bringing up California, but you know, we have a new code every 3 years. I think even the IBC cycles about
every 3 years.
Yeah, so that that every 3 years gets you an opportunity to get the latest and greatest and make technological enhancements and
right. And to correct things that aren't working out.
That's the big thing. Yeah. Oh, we made a mistake there, and this is codified, and now we're stuck with it. You can go back and change it. So that's exactly. super helpful. I love that, Marcia. Appreciate you sharing that. And I can't close out without mentioning our good friend Dom Marinelli over at the U.S. Access Board and thanking him for connecting us and introducing us. And he's a good guy. I've known him for a while, and I know you've had a relationship for a long time. But tell us a little bit about what you and Dom are doing over there at the United Spinal. What is the organization all about? And you know, how do you help people? And how do you advance disabilities in your organization?
United Spinal. I work for Accessibility Services, which is a program of the United Spinal Association, which is a membership organization. And United Spinal as a whole is dedicated to making life, you know, more livable and increasing the independence of people who use wheelchairs primarily.
Okay.
Spinal cord injuries or spinal cord problems. And Accessibility Services existed since before United Spinal existed. Accessibility Services was first a program of Eastern Paralyzed Veterans Association, which is what United Spinal became ultimately. And Accessibility Services works with clients to ensure accessibility to their buildings and facilities, either through plans review, inspections, on-site inspections, all kinds of services that I'm sure you're familiar with. And I sometimes get involved in those, but mostly I do their non-revenue work, which is the representation on building codes and standards and the development of new accessibility requirements.
Okay.
I'm old enough that I could say, no, I'm going to travel all over the place and I'm not going to bend over and pick up that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, not spending time measuring urinals and toilets. You're better suited doing something.
The younger folk are much more nimble and faster and therefore better.
Yeah. My business partner, Mark Wood, is the same way. He's like, unless there's a golf course nearby or something like that, he's not going. So, or if it's in Hawaii, maybe he'll go, but, Pebble Beach maybe, but, no, this is great. I appreciate, all that, Marcia. It's been a pleasure to meet you. And spend some time with you here. What's the best time to connect with you? Should people reach out at the United Spinal your LinkedIn or
email me at mmazz@unitedspinal.org.
Okay. I'll put that in the show notes along with the United Spinal link to the website. And is it okay if I include your LinkedIn?
And to Accessibility Services has its own.
Okay. I'll put your email, both websites and your LinkedIn in the show notes. So if you're listening or you're driving, you can go back and look at the show notes and connect with Marcia. She's just a plethora of knowledge. If you want to know the history, I mean, she was at the US Access Board before the ADA even. And so all that history is all there. And I know they do consulting and a lot of work through Accessibility Services and some great, great work at United Spinal. So I just want to thank you so much for coming in today, Marcia, and spending some time with me and sharing your wisdom with my listeners. And it's just been awesome.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity. This is great, and I'm happy to be connecting with all of your listeners, watchers.
Yeah, absolutely. We're trying to bring some entertainment, some fun to this topic. A lot of times, you know, the sessions you've seen over the years, that sometimes they're very federal and government-y, if you will. I'm trying to bring a little bit of fun and sometimes I say things on air here and I go back, I listen, oh man, I misquoted that. And I think I said something a minute ago. I'm like, ah, oh, I can't edit that out. but hey, I'm having fun. And
I'm enjoying that I can say exactly what I think these days because I no longer work for the government.
Yeah, no more filter.
Yep.
No more filter. Well, with that, we might even title the episode that. With that, we'll say thank you so much, Marcia. We'll be in touch again and tell Dom I said hello and appreciate you guys coming. All right. We'll talk to you soon. Everybody else out there, have a great day. We'll see you on the next show. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.